Aerodynamics Information Technology, the Technology and IT Services Business Unit within General Dynamics Corporation. GDIT has 28,000 employees worldwide and a revenue of approximately $8.5 billion. Amy proudly graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy and served in the U.S. Navy prior to her nearly two decades of leadership positions at General Dynamics. She has been recognized with industry awards, including Washingtonian Tech, Titan, and the Wash 100. And thank you for joining us here today, and welcome.
Grateful to be partnering with the community here today, working toward a more pleased to welcome Dr. Marvin Adams, NNSA Deputy Administrator for Defense Programs, who will provide an update from the Office of Defense Programs on how they are fulfilling the administration's priority to maintain the safety, security, and reliability of the nation's strategic deterrent. Dr. Adams, over to you.
Got to start going faster. There's a lot of implications on that. You've heard heard about the Enhanced Mission Delivery Initiative that's aimed at, let me say, getting some friction out of our system so that we can go faster. But there's more to it than that. If we're going to have warhead modernization programs or development programs that, say, take less than 10 years, then technologies need to be ready at the beginning to a greater extent than today we've been providing. So there's a maturation and insertion component that's buried under that effective word that isn't obvious, right? So that's just an example of some of the things that derive from those five words. Next slide, please. So job one is to take care of the warheads that are out there in the stockpile today. There's a lot that goes on there. Obviously, our surveillance program, you're probably aware that we do an extensive annual assessment of every warhead type that's out there. So surveillance findings, a lot of assessment and analysis that goes into, you know, somebody says, hey, look what I found, a bit of corrosion here. What's the impact of that? Turns out that can be a hard question sometimes to answer. And we can't say, well, let's throw it down in a hole and blow it up and see if it works. That wouldn't really give us the kind of understanding we want anyway. But so some of these questions are pretty hard. Is this thing still effective, safe, secure, and reliable, given the surveillance findings we've had? Or do we need to change something? I'll leave that as that, but I just want you to know, everybody focuses on our construction and our warhead modernization programs. Job one is to take care of today's stockpile, and that's not trivial. Next slide, please. So we are updating warheads, that's the NNSA job, but it's coupled to what the Department of Defense is doing, which is updating pretty much all the delivery systems. This is a kind of busy chart, but it shows on the left where we are currently with our three legs of the triad. We have air-based systems, land-based systems, and sea-based systems. In the middle, that lists the five warhead modernization programs that are underway today. Up at the top, the B-61-12, that life extension program, that is in full rate production now. So we're putting those out, sending them to the Air Force. The W-80-4 life extension program will go into production later in the 2020s. We expect the first production unit of that warhead to be in 2027. The W-87-1 modification program is scheduled to go into production in the early 2030s. The W-87-1, as you can see there, will go on to the Sentinel, which is the replacement for the Minuteman III ICBM. On the sea leg, the W-88 Alteration 370 is also in production right now. So those altered warheads are being delivered to the Navy now. And that will go on for the coming years. The W-93 program is our newest one that's underway. And it is slated to go into production later in the 2030s. Following on after the W-87-1 begins its production. So that's how things are stacked up. We have two in production now, one that will go into production later in the 2020s, one in the early 2030s, and one a little later in the 2030s. Those five things are all being actively developed now. Next slide, please. This is another picture of that. There's not a whole lot on here that I didn't just talk through in that previous slide. I will point out that for a lot of these, in a lot of these cases, the altered or modified or life extended warhead does have to meet different requirements than what it's replacing. And in the W-93 case, it's not just a replacement. That's actually a new design. So, and that's something we haven't done in a long, long time in this country. Let me also remark that the W-87 represents a milestone for defense programs and the NNSA in general in the following sense. Every component that we put into those W87-1 warheads that we're going to deliver to the Air Force, every component will be newly manufactured. I mean, that's the plan. Everyone will be new. We're not reusing components for that warhead, and that's a first since the end of the Cold War. That presumes that we're able to manufacture all of those parts. We'll get to that in a minute. Next slide, please. You've probably seen a picture like this before. It just lets you know that there are a lot of sites across the country that have to do their jobs in order for us to execute the programs I just described. I'm not going to go through all of this. Next slide, please. Let me say a few words about infrastructure. I struggled a little bit with how to show you without making your eyes completely glaze over the scale and breadth of our infrastructure programs, our construction efforts. So I decided to group them by rough expected cost amount. So we've got one. I expect Savannah River Plutonium Processing Facility to end up costing more than $10 billion. So it's up there by itself. In the $5 to $10 billion range is the uranium processing facility. And you see that, as you heard yesterday, if you were here last night, the Savannah River effort is still in the design phase. The uranium processing facility is in its execution phase. That is, for it, its construction. We've got several projects that we think we're going to end up costing between $1 and $5 billion. So what you see on this page is there's a bunch of things going on that are in the multi-billion dollar range that have to do with our infrastructure. And you see that there's a mix in some of these. Let me just take the Los Alamos Plutonium Fifth Production Project, LAP-4. It has, I believe, five sub-projects under it. So when I say execution and design, some of the sub-projects are being executed, some are still in the design phase. So that's part of the next level of complexity under there. And those sub-projects all have their own costs and schedules, but they're all being executed in parallel. The ones that are in execution are being executed in parallel. The ones that are in design are being designed in parallel. So the point here is that there's a lot going on all the way from design through construction and turnover to operations. Next slide, please. And there's an awful lot going on that is pretty big by most standards, but hopefully doesn't come in over that $1 billion threshold. You see some of that here. So what I hope you see on these slides is that all of our sites are pretty busy with this. Administrator Ruby commented yesterday morning that we have to, given the labor shortages and supply chain things that we're seeing these days, we've got to take a step back and look at this and say, are we competing against ourselves? Are we fighting over the same electricians at the same site to try to do things in parallel? We've got to really take a hard look at that. So the point of those two slides is to say that yeah, we've got five warhead modernization programs underway. Yes, we're taking care of today's stockpile, which is a job in itself. But at the same time, if we're going to deliver on those modernization programs, like the W87-1, which I told you, hopefully we'll have all newly manufactured components in it. We have to finish these things. We have to execute these infrastructure projects so that we are able to manufacture what's needed and deliver the warheads. Next slide, please. I mentioned secure transportation. We don't talk a lot about it, and that's good. It's not in the news, and that's good. These folks are really good at what they do. They operate under the radar, quietly executing hundreds of missions a year, safely, securely, and like I said, not making headlines. Place where we don't want to make headlines. They're good at it, but they can't take their eye off the ball. This is challenging. And let me say here, you know, that as technology advances, the folks who would like to create mischief have more and more tools at their disposal to do so. So it's not like you have to invent, you know, your 10-foot tall, infinitely powerful adversary. Technology is coming on and giving your ordinary humans more and more tools that they can use to create mischief. And as that happens, we have to adapt. We have to stay a step ahead. That requires good intelligence. So we have to know what potential adversaries might be up to. And it requires technology developments. And ironically or perversely, as you introduce new technologies into our systems, into our security systems and our safety systems, for example, you might be introducing new attack surfaces. So this whole business is kind of complicated. Next slide, please. So a lot of times you hear a lot about our forehead modernization programs, you hear a lot about our construction, our infrastructure programs. And then people, oh, and then there's that science thing. Well, there's that science thing. Oh, by the way, did you guys hear about ignition? So this science part is not just our investments that will pay off in 20 years. This is capabilities that our production modernization, our warhead modernization programs, and our stockpile sustainment efforts use every day. So if you can imagine doing an assessment of a surveillance finding without using computers, now that's what it would look like without our science program. Our science program is providing the tools that are used every day today, in addition to doing R&D and tech math for tomorrow. So this is what funds the National Ignition Facility, for example. So that ignition experiment that happened last December was funded out of this program. The exascale computer that we should have up and running before too terribly long at Livermore, called El Capitan, that comes out of this program. You may not realize it, but you've probably heard of the capabilities that we're developing for doing experiments underground in Nevada, subcritical experiments with plutonium, the enhanced capabilities for subcritical experiments. That's paid for out of this program. That's a tool that we're going to use to continue to be able to assess our warheads without doing nuclear explosive testing. So a lot of that stockpile stewardship, maintaining our ability to certify and assess our warheads without resorting to nuclear explosive testing, those capabilities are paid for out of this SRT&E, Science Research Technology Engineering portfolio. Another thing I want to say about this, I'd like to tie back to the workforce part. So you've heard a lot about our workforce challenges in terms of numbers. Administrator Ruby mentioned yesterday morning that across our complex last year we hired 11,000 people, but we lost 7,000, so we netted 4,000. What I want to get you thinking about is that this is not just a numbers game. So there's no number of fresh bachelor's degree engineers that you can hire that can do what somebody with 25 or 30 years of weapons design experience can do. It takes a while to develop the sort of judgment we need. We are not today and won't be in the foreseeable future at the point where we've got these, you know, pristine, wonderful simulation tools that exactly reflect reality. We're not there, we're not gonna be there. The processes we have to model are too complicated. So when questions are asked about some sort of assessment or another, there's going to be some judgment involved. And there's going to be somebody who's going to look at simulation results and experiment results and the question at hand and Here's my answer and here's my confidence level. Here's my error bounds. How do you develop that judgment? Well, I want you to think. Let's go back to that ignition thing. So the National Ignition Facility has been trying for more than a decade. The scientists involved have been trying for more than a decade to make that happen at the NIF. The team that was responsible for ignition experiments in the National Ignition Campaign from something like 2010 to 2012, they had really good calculations that gave them confidence that they were going to reach ignition and that they had a lot of margin and laser energy to do that. One of the ways you develop judgment in this business is to make a prediction. You know, evaluate your confidence in it, and then go do the experiment and get surprised. So that is a big part of our workforce development, is having these kinds of experimental facilities where early career people can make a prediction, and often they're going to be very confident about it, and then go measure it and get surprised. That is so important. So those are the people who are developing judgment in how much can I trust my computational tools and what level of humility in the face of nature should I have? Now you can't take that too far, right? If I have a quarter here and I'm going to drop it on the stage and I need to estimate when it's going to hit the ground, I can't say I'm so humble in the face of nature that I can't calculate that, right? Because I've never done that experiment before. I dropped a quarter in another room, but I haven't dropped it here. Now, empirically, I can't say when it's going to hit the ground. Now, you've got to take some credit for scientific understanding. But knowing when you can do that and when you need to back off and say, well, this is a little more complicated. Oh, there's an air vent blowing up right there. I better be careful with my prediction. So I wanted to tie that to the workforce thing. These experimental tools that we have are very important components. Especially today, I'm going to keep going a little bit on this. Today, when we haven't done a nuclear explosive test since September of 92, more than three decades ago, we don't go out there and make the ground shake to demonstrate that our weapons work. Now you have to take our word for it, right? If you want to, what's the credibility of our deterrent right now? But it's based on taking the word of our laboratories, our scientists and engineers for it. How do we know? How does the world know that they know what they're doing? Did you hear about ignition? So, you know, that was a hard thing. That demonstrates that our scientists and engineers in this weapons relevant area are leading the world. And that gives our deterrent some credibility. So, also a workforce thing. I don't know if there's another slide. Can you go advance? Yeah, there's that one. Okay, I'm back.
Jason report said hit lifetime is roughly 85 to 100 years at a minimum.
Have you read it?
Sorry?
Have you read it?
Jason report? I've read this 2006 summary of the report. Yeah. So please clarify what I'm missing when I do quote the Jason report.
I will be happy to. So first of all, there is an unclassified Jason letter report from 2019 that gives an updated Jason view on this topic. That Jason report recommends that we build a pit production capability as soon as possible. Just say that for starters. The 2006 Jason report, I joined the group right after that report, so I didn't have anything to do with writing it, but I have read it. There are things that are picked out of that that I believe have been taken out of context. If you read the whole report, you find that even in 2006, the Jasons recognized that blanket statements like about pit lifetime that don't take into account the details of the system, the system specifics, those blanket statements aren't right. So there are systems that are more forgiving than others. There's no question that there is some degradation as these pits age. Let me just give you a little insight into what's going on in the microstructure there as the pit ages. So plutonium-239 has a long half-life, it's 24,000 years. But even with that long half-life, there are enough decays going on in 50 years that the following is true. If you look at a cubic centimeter of plutonium, over the course of 50 years, there's enough plutonium-239 atoms that have decayed. And when they decay, they become uranium-235 and helium-4. So let's focus on the helium-4. Enough helium-4 is produced in that cubic centimeter of material that if you let it expand to room temperature and pressure, it would take up a cubic centimeter. And at 100 years, it's 2 cubic centimeters. So after 100 years, every centimeter of that material, that metal, has buried in it enough helium that if it expanded, it would be 2 cubic centimeters. And after 50 to 100 years, every plutonium atom in that metal matrix has been knocked off of its lattice site multiple times. So there's stuff going on there. And understanding what that means to weapons performance is tricky. I got a briefing recently on the Livermore and Los Alamos understanding and trying to bound those effects. It's a complicated thing to try to bound those effects. A lot of progress is being made, but we are still not to the point where we can confidently say that in every system, the pit that's in that system will last 100 years. We're not close to that yet. There's a lot of uncertainty left. Especially when you consider all the environments that our warheads have to go through. So just to start off with a blanket statement and say, you know, pits last 100 years or something is really, really oversimplified. Does that answer it?
Okay, let's take one from the app here. Dr. Adams, at the end of the day, what is the biggest challenge facing NNSA today? Is it people, capacity, infrastructure, or the risk adverse nature of the complex? Or all the above?
Yeah, it's more. It's a lot of the above. We can't just focus on one challenge and ignore the rest. So, again, if we go back to my first slide, there's a bunch of challenges associated with deliver. There's a bunch of challenges associated with safe, secure, and reliable. And there's a bunch of challenges underneath that effective thing. I will say this, that you can't do any of this without an expert workforce. So that's foundational. We can't do any of this without sufficient resources. And I want to make a point that I didn't get a chance to yesterday during the pit production talk. You heard Stuart talking about our early procurements at Savannah River. Those are possible because of an appropriation from Congress this year in FY23 that gave Savannah River enough funding that they can do those early procurements. So the resources that are appropriated from Congress, the advocacy from colleagues that support that. All of these things are necessary in order to do the things that are on this slide. So we can't just focus on one and ignore the rest. There are a bunch of things that are necessary but not sufficient. And I would say everything you listed is necessary but not sufficient. Dan, surprise, surprise.
Thanks for coming back. I was looking at the slide with all the projects on it, and I saw the I think it was a sub-project for enhanced capabilities for subcritical experiments. So for this question, just considering that thing, whole hog, the sub-projects to do to expand the U1A complex, and Lionel's contribution. I'm sorry, the Lionel people in the room. I don't remember the new one. It's the Scorpius successor. The instrument that will actually go down there.
The Scorpius is the one going down.
Oh, that's the new
it's
one.
It's a Cygnus.
Right. So all of that, when will all of that be ready to actually be used in a subcritical experiment right now, as far as you can foretell?
Yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head. I will say that those dates have changed a lot in the last year, just like everything else we're doing. We have found in the course of the last year that a lot of the timelines for our construction efforts in Alcantis is one of those are longer than we had thought. And so what happens in these cases, I'll just give you a window into what I see. So we think our completion date's gonna be here. And we try to hold that. We use up management reserve and contingency and all that stuff, but then it becomes clear that we ain't gonna make it. So then we start re-baselining and redoing a whole bunch of schedule stuff, and it looks like we can do it here, but then we put some management reserve and contingency on that. So the new date is out here, but I hesitate to say that those are our scheduled dates. That's the sort of estimate now of the last possible day it could become a reality. And my view is, if you go all the way out and use all of your contingency and reserve and all that, then you've kind of failed. So, but the real answer to your question is, I don't know it off the top of my head.
Sure. Or a question that's just as helpful maybe is, which LEP or alteration or whichever it's going to be called will need that first?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked a question with the need word in it. There's a lot packed in there. The truth is, and we've not been very good at telling this kind of complicated truth, the truth is that our scientists and engineers who are doing these assessments and who have to certify designs are going to do the best they can with the tools they have. And they'll have to be more conservative if they don't have the tools that they would rather have, but the fact is that if ECSE slips, then the W80-4 and the W87-1 and the W93 folks will have to find another way to answer their questions. They just won't be able to answer them with as much confidence. So I try not to. This is true when I'm talking to Congress. I don't want to say things like, if we don't have this capability by here, we can't steward the stockpile anymore. That's just not true. We're going to steward the stockpile to the best of our ability with the tools that we have available at any given time. But, oh my gosh, if we don't get some of these tools developed pretty soon, it's going to be very difficult to answer the questions about a whole lot of them.
Thank you, Dr. Adams. I'd now like to invite Amy to join Dr. Adams back on stage for a fireside discussion on the work.
Go away.
Great. As discussed yesterday during a couple of sessions, several of the sessions, workforce continues to be a challenge and opportunity. Mission. I invited Dr. Adams and Amy Gilliland back to close out our session with a discussion on this important topic, the need for a diverse talent workforce. workforce is really essential to executing the mission. So Amy, can you speak to the important imperative, particularly the industry's role in providing talent?
I think when we were talking about it the other day, we both have a role, we both have workforces, and I think you made the point that you can't do anything that you just described in your remarks without a workforce. And I think it's really interesting right now. We're at a bit of an inflection point in the workforce. From my perspective, I think the workforce is reevaluating what work means in the aftermath of the pandemic. For us, and you described it in your remarks also, we have a change in the workforce. We have workforce that's retiring, and we have a workforce that's coming on. 40% of our workforce right now is millennials and Gen Z. And so when you add that to the fact that people are looking for an import in what they do, we as employers really need to think about what that means. And then technology is evolving. And so, you know, for GIT, we are spending a lot of time telling the story about the mission. People resonate with the mission that matters, and clearly your mission matters. Have you heard about Ignite? But really getting that story out there, because sometimes there are restrictions on the environments that we work in that discourage the prospective workforce from coming. And they do care desperately about the mission, but they want to know that we're doing cool things. And you're clearly doing cool things, but as an employer, I think we have a responsibility to tell that story. We do work that matters, and we are on the cutting edge. Secondly, people want to work in a place where they feel supported. You know, from a diversity and inclusion perspective, but also that they have a trajectory. Their employees see, their employer sees what's in the future for them. And so mobility is really important. And I think what resonated with me about your remarks in that regard is you want people to have a lot of different experiences, because those experiences are what give them the judgment in your quarter experiment. Right? They need to have a lot of those experiences. So as an employer, we're using technology tools like AI to give employees choice. So you can put into our Netflix-like tool what you're interested in doing, and it helps accelerate those moves inside the company, which I think we all benefit from as a company. And then finally, on the technology and evolution part, we as an employer have a responsibility to continue to evolve our workforce, one, in giving them certifications, because the technology that's going to deliver the warheads that are going on the Columbia class is different than the technology that were on the Ohio class and prior classes. And so we are really focusing on those certifications and upskilling. That also, by the way, helps employees understand that you're vested in them. It helps evolve the workforce. So I think there's a lot that goes into it. And at the end of the day, Mariana and I were talking, you know, people want to work for a company that has a soul. They want to work for a place that people think cares about them. And so we're trying to do that. But certainly, that's our side of the equation.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. Boy, there's a lot there that I can pick up on and elaborate on. I want to talk about the diversity, equity, accessibility part. I think we all need to get better at that, making our workplaces more equitable, more inclusive, more accessible. I think a lot of us are trying to go hard on that. And you know, there are two very different kinds of reasons to do it. One is it's the right thing to do, and that's pretty compelling. Another though is, oh my gosh, if you look at our situation right now, we would be crazy to leave a pool of talent on the sidelines. We need all we can get. So to exclude a pool of talent, given what I just laid out for you, it would be foolhardy. So two very different kinds of reasons, but they drive the same thing. We need to make our workplaces better, more inviting, the kind of place that people want to work. We're in a competitive environment right now, and I would be so happy if, for example, defense programs were known for its diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility such a way that that gives us an advantage in that hiring competition over some of the other people who are trying to go after the same workforce. So that's one of the things I wanted to pick up on. We do have a lot of initiatives underway in that regard. I think it's really important. Again, partly from the point of view it's the right thing to do, but partly from purely selfish, I want to get my mission done. We need all that talent. As far as the generational change and the pandemic-induced changes, we're struggling with that, I gotta say. In our world, it's a good thing that, you know, I was a university professor for 30 years. We didn't teach nuclear weapons design, right? We taught a lot of fundamental things, but to really learn how to be a nuclear weapons designer at Livermore, Los Alamos, or Sandia, you've got to go there and learn it. Learn it as you do it. And it takes a while. It's very difficult for me to imagine how we could have a transient workforce that comes in for 3 to 5 years and moves on and do the things we need to do. It's very difficult for me to imagine that. James Peary and I have had some discussions about this. And again, I'll go back and say, you know, give me a 1,000 people with less than 3 years experience, or give me 5 really top-notch folks, and I'll pick the 5 and I'll beat you. You know, it's not just a numbers game. So that's another one of our challenges right now. And I don't have a great solution to it. You've mentioned a lot of strategies. We have a lot of strategies, but I guess time will tell if our strategies solve the problems.
Keep chipping away at it.
Yeah, I don't think there's one magic bullet.
I agree.
Dr. Adams, we heard yesterday from Dr. Ruby about the net gain of 11,000, but then the net loss is 7,000, so total net gain of 4,000. In that light, what do you see as the highest workforce needs in executing your office's priorities?
Oh, I hate to keep saying all of the above, but it's really pretty true. I guess if I had to pick for the next 6 months, I'd look for electricians. our construction projects are starting for electricians. Just at UPF, they've got something like 200 miles of electrical cable delay, conduit and cable. They've got something like 500 electricians showing up every day, and they need 800. That's just one of those projects that was on that chart. Los Alamos also, we've taken a look at Los Alamos at optimizing the use of the facility time and not relegating the equipment work, the decontamination, demolition, removal, and installation, not relegating that to the second and third shifts. So opening up more time for equipment work. Well, do you have enough people to staff 3 shifts? That's pretty hard up on the hill at Los Alamos. So right now, what's on my mind the most right now is the labor shortages that are associated with those construction and infrastructure projects. So that's a really high priority. At the same time, we can't take our eye off the ball in the technology development, the weapons design and assessment world either. We have a lot of work to do here, as you saw.
Amy, we see the statistics of mental health challenges. We know how important that is in GDIT. So I was wondering if you could share that, your perspectives on that, and what GDIT is an industry, as an example, is doing to address that.
Yeah, sure. So one thing we've been talking about post-pandemic also, and we see in the articles out this week, with alarming statistics about teenage girls and their mental health and how they've applied to the surveys. But we see in our workforce themselves and also in their families significant mental health issues in the aftermath of the pandemic. And, you know, at its heart, I view that as a national security issue because you want a workforce that is healthy in mind and body that comes to work, whether they be your electricians or your technologists or your Ignite folks. And, you know, sometimes with the kinds of clearances that the workforce has, it can become taboo to talk about mental health issues, and people are afraid that if they do that, they will lose their clearance. And so we at GDIT have tried to normalize the discussion. You won't actually lose your clearance if you need to talk to somebody. That's very normal. And so trying to have that discussion and also provide resources so that people feel supported. And we have found that that has really remarkably helped. We have a whole series of resources on our website that are available to the public and also to our employees. And just even being able to have that discussion, hey, I'm not all right, or I need a time out today, or my kid is dealing with this. And the realization that the numbers are startling, and that means that a good number of people in this room are experiencing that or have experienced it. I think that's an important part as employers. We're always pushing health programs, but we don't often talk about the mental part, and I think that there's an acute need for that now. Something we ask each other, how are you really? So it'd be like, Marv, how are you? And you go off to the coffee machine, and I don't really listen to what you say, but how are you really? And I actually sit for a second, and I care about your response, and we're trying to encourage that and create that kind of in the workforce and makes a difference.
I think that's great. There are probably some things we can learn from you. We of course have similar efforts, but again, this is one of those things where there's not just a couple of magic bullets. Even before the pandemic, I saw statistics, I can't remember the numbers exactly, but it's a surprisingly high fraction of the adult population in the U.S.
One in five.
A diagnosable mental illness in a given year, even pre-pandemic.
Yes, yeah. One in five.
Yeah, I was thinking one in five, one in four was about right. So that's pre-pandemic. And I think the effects of the pandemic on mental health across the board are probably still not known, but probably larger than people think.
Well, we have a bunch of veterans in the workforce and veterans have a much higher.
So it's quite possible that we could learn some tricks from each other. But I'm interested in that.
Important conversation.
It is, yeah.
Great. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. So, Dr. Adams, are you ready for another pit question, or are you pitted out?
I love pits.
All right. Here we go. What lessons learned from the prior MOX project at Savannah River help you succeed there with PITS going forward?
You know, I didn't have much to do with that MOX project. One of the lessons that I saw from afar is that if you underfund a project, it will take forever and cost infinity.
I'm familiar with that.
Yeah. I'm pleased and grateful, all sorts of words like that, to find that from the time when I walked into the office 10 months ago, it was just a few days before my boss, Administrator Ruby, sent an unfunded requirements letter to Congress, and it was about money for these advanced procurements at Savannah River Plutonium Processing Facility, SRPPF. We had conversations with OMB and DOD and appropriators throughout the summer and fall, and in the end, we got that money in the omnibus bill that was passed right at the end of December last year. That has enabled Stewart and Company to go out and actually put the money on the table for the glove box manufacturers and for the other long lead stuff, and to go ahead and get started on some of the things that we can start on there, not leave everything for later, all piled up in a great big work glut on the same footprint. So I would say that is a lesson learned and applied from the MOX project. We were able to have those conversations, and facts and logic prevailed, and it took a little bit of a leap of faith on the point of the appropriators from their perspective. Can you really execute that much in one fiscal year? We'll see. You know, we're really going all out to do that. But that's an example.
Great, thank you. I see the clock, we're past zero. So, on behalf of the audience, everyone here, we want to thank you, Amy and Dr. Adams, for your insight this morning. We're glad you could join us today. Thank you very much.